This is a Vision Australia Radio podcast.
Welcome to Cover from Vision Australia Radio. I'm Tim McQueen. This is program number 500. We broadcast through Vision Australia Radio to southern New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia, Northern Territory and Western Australia, as well as through Radio for the Print Handicapped Tasmania, Hobart, Launceston and Devonport, and Hope FM in Esperance, Western Australia. Over the last 10 years, 25 readers have read around about 1,500 stories by 500 different authors. I'm always keen to promote Australian authors, and we've had 20 or so authors reading from their own work, 6 specials by Erwood writers, and a couple of programs with work from Bayside writers. In 2019, the most read author was Alastair Cook. I was reading his Letters from America. In 2020, Helen MacDonald from Elwood Writers. In 2021, Rysad Kapuscinski. Richard Lovell was reading from his work. 2022, we had Bruce Lees, who's a volunteer from Bendigo, with his own writing. And in 2023, our favourite author has been Alan Marshall. In today's programme, we hear again from Alan Marshall with Tips for Birthdays, read by Barry Leveny, who also reads A Parisian Affair by Guy de Maupassant, and I read Unnecessary Gifts by Fiona MacFarlane. Here's Barry Leveny.
A Parisian Affair by Guy de Maupassant. Is there any keener sense known to man than woman's curiosity? There is nothing in the world she would not do in order to satisfy it, to know for certain, to grasp and possess what has hitherto remained in her imagination. What would she not do to achieve that? When her impatient curiosity is at its height, she will shrink from nothing, and there is no folly to which she will not stoop, no obstacle she will not overcome. I refer, of course, to the really feminine woman, the sort who on the surface may appear quite reasonable and objective, but whose three secret weapons are always in a high state of readiness. The first is a kind of watchful, womanly concern for what is happening around her. The second, even more deadly in its effect, is guile disguised as common decency. And the third is the exquisite capacity for deception and infinite variety which drives some men to throw themselves at her feet and others off the parapets of bridges. The one whose story I want to tell you about was a little provincial woman who had led until then a boringly blameless life. Her outwardly calm existence was spent looking after her family, a very busy husband and 2 children whose upbringing, in her hands, was exemplary in every way. But her heart was ravaged by an all-consuming, indefinable desire. She thought constantly about Paris and avidly read all the society pages in the papers, their accounts of receptions, celebrations, the clothes worn, and all the accompanying delights enjoyed, whetted her appetite still further. Above all, however, she was fascinated by what these reports merely hinted at. The cleverly phrased allusions half lifted a veil, beyond which could be glimpsed devastatingly attractive horizons, promising a whole new world of wicked pleasure. From where she lived, she looked on Paris as representing the height of all magnificent luxury, as well as licentiousness. Throughout the long, dream-filled night, lulled by the regular snoring of her husband sleeping next to her on his back with a scarf wrapped around his head, she conjured up the images of all the famous men who made the headlines and shone like brilliant comets in the darkness of her sombre sky. She pictured the madly exciting lives they must lead, moving from one den of vice to the next, indulging in never-ending and extraordinarily voluptuous orgies, and practicing such complex and sophisticated sex as to defy imagination. It seemed to her that hidden behind the facades of the houses lining the canyon-like boulevards of the city, some amazing erotic secret must lie. And she herself was growing old. She was growing old, never having known a thing about life beyond the hideously banal monotony of regularly performed duties, which, by all accounts, was what happily married life consisted of. She was still pretty. The uneventful life she lived had preserved her like a winter apple in an attic. Yet she was consumed from within by unspoken and obsessive desires. She wondered if she would die without ever having tasted the wicked delights which life had to offer. Without ever, not even once, having plunged into the ocean of voluptuous pleasure which, to her, was Paris. After long and careful preparation, she decided to put into action a plan to get there. She invented a pretext, got herself invited by some relatives, and, since her husband was unable to accompany her, left for the city alone. The alleged discovery of some long-lost friends living in one of its leafy suburbs enabled her, as soon as she arrived, to prolong her stay by a couple of days, or rather nights, if necessary. Her search began. Up and down the boulevard she walked, seeing nothing particularly wicked or sinful. She cast her eye inside all the well-known cafes, and each morning her avid reading of The Figaro's Lonely Hearts column was a fresh reminder to her of the call of love. But she found nothing that might lead her to the great orgies she imagined actresses and artists enjoyed all the time. Nowhere could she discover the dens of iniquity about which she had dreamed. Without the necessary open sesame, she remained debarred from Ali Baba's cave. Uninitiated, she stood on the threshold of the catacombs, where the secret rites of a forbidden religion were performed. Her petty bourgeois relatives could offer her an introduction to none of the fashionable men whose names buzzed in her ears. In despair, she had almost decided to give up when, finally, happy chance intervened. One day, as she was walking down the Chaussée d'Antin, she stopped to look at the window of a shop selling Japanese bibelots in such gay, cheerful colours as to delight the eye. She was looking thoughtfully at its amusing little ivories, its huge oriental vases of vivid enamel work, and its strange bronzes, when she heard from within the voice of the proprietor. With low, reverential bows, he was showing a fat, bald-headed little man with grizzled stubble the figure of a pot-bellied Buddha, the only one of its kind, or so he claimed. With each of the merchant's utterances, the famous name of his customer sounded like a clarion call in her ears. The other browsers, young ladies and elegant gentlemen, cast oblique, highly respectful glances in the direction of the well-known author, who was absorbed in his examination of the figure. One was as ugly as the other. The pair might have been taken for brothers. "To you, Monsieur Jean Varin," the shopkeeper was saying, "I'll let it go for 1,000. Cost, in other words. To anyone else, it would be 1,500. My artist customers mean a lot to me. I like to offer them a special price. Oh yes, they all come to me, you know, Monsieur Jean Varin. Yesterday, for example, Monsieur Busnach bought an antique goblet from me. And the other day... You see those candlesticks over there? Aren't they lovely? Sort of pair like them to Monsieur Alexandre Dumas. And I mean, that piece you've got there. If Monsieur Zola saw that, it'd be gone in 5 minutes. I can assure you, Monsieur Valin." The writer hesitated, undecided. He was obviously attracted to the figure, but not the price. Had he been standing quite alone in the middle of a desert, he could not have been more oblivious of the interest he was arousing. Trembling, she went in. Young, handsome, elegant or not, it was nevertheless Jean Varin himself, and on Jean Varin alone she now fixed a bold gaze. Still struggling with himself, he finally replaced the figure on the table. "No," he said, "it's too expensive." The merchant redoubled his efforts. "Too expensive, Monsieur Jean Varin? But you know it's worth 2,000 if it's worth a franc." Sadly, as he continued to gaze into the enamelled eyes of the figure, the man of letters replied, "I'm sure it is, but it's too expensive for me." At this, wildly daring, she stepped forward and said, "Supposing I were to ask, what would it be to me?" Surprised, the merchant replied, 1,500, madame. I'll take it." The writer, who until then had been totally unaware of her presence, turned round quickly and at first somewhat coldly looked her up and down. Then he cast more of a connoisseur's eye over her. She was charming, vibrant, and suddenly lit up by the flame which had till this second been dormant within her. After all, a woman who snaps up a curio at 1,500 is not exactly run-of-the-mill. With exquisite delicacy in her movement, she turned to face him now and said in a trembling voice, "I'm so sorry, monsieur. I'm afraid I rather rushed in. Perhaps you had not yet decided." He bowed. "I had indeed, madame." In a voice shaking with emotion, she said, "If you should ever change your mind, either today or at some later time, it shall be yours. I bought it solely because you liked it." Visibly flattered, he smiled. "But how on earth do you know who I am?" he inquired. She listed his works and expressed with some eloquence her admiration of them. Leaning his elbows on a piece of furniture, he settled down to a conversation, weighing her up all the while with his penetrating gaze. New customers had come into the shop, and from time to time the merchant, delighted with such living testimony to the excellence of his stock, called from one end of the shop to the other. "There you are! You see, Monsieur Jean Varin! What about that, then?" Everyone looked over, and she felt a thrill of pleasure at being seen chatting on such intimate terms with one of the great and the good. Dizzy with success, she felt like a general about to make one supremely daring attack. "Monsieur," she said, "would you do me a very great favour? Will you let me give you this figure as a keepsake from a woman of 10 minutes' acquaintance who has the most ardent admiration for you?" He refused. She insisted. Laughing happily, he resisted yet again, but she was determined. "In that case, I shall take it to your home straight away. Where do you live?" He refused to give his address, but having acquired it from the merchant as she paid, she rushed off to find the fiacre. The writer ran to catch her up, unwilling to expose himself by accepting this gift from a total stranger, and, with it, who knew what sort of obligation? Reaching her just as she was jumping into the cab, he flung himself in and nearly fell on top of her as it jolted into motion. He sat down beside her, more than a little embarrassed. She was quite intractable. His protests and pleas fell on deaf ears. As they arrived at the door, she set out her conditions. "I shall agree not to leave it with you if, throughout the whole of today, you will carry out all my wishes." The whole thing sounded so extraordinarily amusing that he accepted. "Now," she said, "what would you normally be doing at this time of day?" After a little hesitation, he said, "I'd be going for a walk." In a firm tone, she ordered, "To the bois!" And off they went. After this, he had to tell her the names of all the women people were talking about, especially the flighty ones, and give her every intimate detail he could about where they lived, how they spent their days, and all their wicked little ways. It was now getting towards evening time, "What do you usually do at this sort of time?" she asked. "Laughing," he replied. "I go for a glass of absinthe." They went into a large boulevard cafe where he was a regular and met all his colleagues. He introduced them to her. She was wild with joy. And in her head there echoed ceaselessly the words, "At last! At last!" Time passed. "Is this where you normally dine?" she asked. "Yes, madame," he replied. "Then, monsieur, let's go and dine," she said. Emerging from the Café Bignon, she asked, "What do you normally do in the evening?" He looked at her steadily. "It depends. Sometimes I go to the theatre." "Well then, monsieur, let's go to the theatre." He was recognised by the management at the Vaudeville, who found seats for them straight away. To crown it all, she was seen by the entire audience, sitting by his side in the first row of the balcony. After the show, he kissed her hand gallantly and said, "It only remains, madame, for me to thank you for a delightful..." She interrupted. "What is it you do at this time of night?" "What do I do?" "You mean, what do I..." "Well, I go home, of course." "In that case, monsieur, let us go to your home," she said, laughing shakily. Not a word more was spoken. From time to time a shiver ran through her, half of terror, half of delight. She was in an exquisite agony, torn between the desire to run away and her determination, in her heart of hearts, to stay and see it through. As they mounted the stairs, her feelings nearly overcame her, and she leaned heavily on the banister, while he wheezed on ahead, carrying a taper. As soon as she was in the bedroom, she undressed quickly, slid wordlessly into bed, and, huddling up against the wall, waited. She was as unsophisticated, however, as only the lawful wife of a country solicitor can be, while he was as demanding as a pasha with three tails. They did not get on at all well. Not at all. Afterwards, he fell asleep. The night hours passed silently, save for the ticking of the clock as, motionless, she thought of her conjugal nights at home. By the yellow light of a Chinese lantern, she looked in dismay at the tubby little man beside her, lying on his back, with the sheet draped over his hot air balloon of a belly. While he snored like a pipe organ, with comic interludes of lengthy, strangulated snorts, the few hairs he possessed, exhausted by the onerous responsibility of masking the ravages of time on his balding skull during the day, now stood perkily on end. A dribble of saliva flowed from the corner of his half-open mouth. When dawn finally broke, light fell through a gap in the drawn curtains. She got up, dressed noiselessly, and had just managed to ease the door open when the latch grated. He woke up and rubbed his eyes. It took a few seconds for him to recover his senses, when the whole affair came flooding back into his mind. "Oh, so, you're leaving then, are you?" he asked. "Well, yes," she stammered. "It's morning." He sat up in bed. "Look," he said, "let me ask something for once, will you?" As she made no reply, he went on. "I don't understand what you've been up to all this time. Since yesterday. Come on, tell me what you're up to. I can't work it out." Gently, she drew closer, blushing like a young girl. "I always wanted to know what it was like to be wicked. And actually, it turns out not to be all that much fun." She ran from the room, flew down the staircase, and flung herself out into the street. Down it, an army of sweepers was sweeping. They swept the pavements and the cobblestones, driving all the litter and filth into the stream of the gutter. With the same regular movement, like reapers in the field, they swept up all in a wide semicircle ahead. As she ran through street after street, still they came to meet her, moving like puppets on a string with the same mechanical mowing movement. She felt as though something inside her, too, had now been swept away. Through the mud, down to the gutter, and finally into the sewer, had gone all the refuse of her overexcited imagination. Returning home, the image of Paris swept inexorably clean by the cold light of day filled her exhausted mind, and as she reached her room, sobs broke from her now quite frozen heart. That was A Parisian Affair by Guy de Maupassant. Tips for Birthdays by Alan Marshall. Birthdays are never the same to me since the tip in front of our place has been reclaimed and turned into a park. A bed of calliopsis now blooms where I found my birthday present for grandfather in 1936, and where Joan, my 8-year-old niece, discovered the EPNS toast rack that she placed before me at the table on my birthday last year. A sign now reads, "Keep off the grass." Ah, that most interesting week before the birthday of a friend, when I tramped the tip in search of a present. No dipping into my pockets, only dipping among carrot tops and turning over retired bath heaters. I never realised the possibilities of the tip as a source of cheap birthday gifts until one day, when we were celebrating my arrival on this earth, my nephew presented me with a solid silver cigarette case with the initials RAL engraved on the front. I was impressed. He handed it to me open. I tried to close it, but that was impossible. A horse had stood on the back and the catch had gone. However, in our family, we never look a gift horse in the mouth. I put it, opened, in my pocket and set off for the tip immediately. Fortunately, our tip was only patronised by the best people. The dustman informed me that the cans he cleared were owned by some of the most influential families in Melbourne. Therefore, our gifts were all of a very high grade. On my last birthday, Grandfather gave me the body of a motor car. He left it down at the tip and told me I could get it whenever I wanted it. I never seemed to want it much. Now it is buried under loads of soil, and men have planted a small tree there. Acacia harpophylla, SQ. In return, on his 75th birthday, I gave Grandfather a cracked phonograph record featuring his favourite song, Come Into the Garden, Maud. When the singer reached the name Maud, he kept repeating it, Maud, 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 until the machine ran down or until you bucked the needle over the crack with your finger. This was difficult because you could never get it on the right line again, and the soloist would often think, Come into the garden, Maud, 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 to faint in his light and to die, die, die. It was not a very good birthday present, although it was most interesting and educational in that it showed you what happens when cracks get in records. I remember one year Joan and I were getting desperate. We were each faced with the problem of finding a present for a friend in the 1 month. For weeks past, the refuse had been of a very poor quality and produced only a few prongless forks and knives without blades. Joan found the lower jawbone of a sheep. It was dry and clean. Now, the lower jawbone of a sheep is a most interesting thing to look at, but it is absolutely useless as far as a present is concerned. None of my friends is interested in such things. Joan and I differ from our friends in that we can look at the lower jawbone of a sheep for quite 10 minutes and enjoy it. So when Joan asked, "Is this any good?" I replied, "The lower jawbone of a sheep is a good thing, but only to you and me." Anyway, we brought it home, but they wouldn't let us bring it inside. Joan once gave me a book marked "With Love from Gladys" in the inside of a plain cover. I don't know the name of this book because all the front pages were torn out. The first page in this copy started at the top with the words, "Gasped tragically." To this day, I can never find out who gasped or why. I used to lie in bed and wonder what he or she was gasping about, but a friend told me that's the way to insomnia. So now I never think about it except on my birthday. And anyway, one never sleeps on birthdays for various reasons, mainly reasons of eating, so it really doesn't matter. Tomorrow is Grandfather's birthday. Excuse me, I must go and buy him a present. That was Tips for Birthdays by Alan Marshall.
Thank you, Barry. Unnecessary Gifts by Fiona McFarlane from her collection The High Places, published by Hamish Hamilton. James is being a sea lily. "Look, Dad," he says, "I'm being a sea lily." Hurried, and with a submarine expression, he waves his small arms backward and forward and drifts around the room. "What would you call this kind of movement?" he asks, waving and drifting. "I don't know," I say. "How about undulating?" He takes this on board. "I am a sea lily undulating above the ocean floor. I look like a plant, but actually I'm an animal." "You look like an animal to me," I say. "And when I die, I'll turn into limestone." He's on the couch now, on tiptoes, and the way his arms wave into the room, it's truly as if they're long green stalks. Somehow I've produced a child who's capable of pulsing with a creepy aquatic languor. I don't know how small boys turned into limestone. I may look like a plant, but actually I'm an animal. I swim around the ocean with my roots. James launches himself from the couch. He spends a fraction of an airborne second transfixed by the compact, floating, disguised life of the sea lily before landing among the carpet fluff, one arm over his face, 1 foot through the plywood of the china cabinet door. For this, he's sent out to find his older brother. He knows he will be able to find Greg at the Wolfsons, the Barters, or possibly the Carrs, although Blake Carr has fallen from neighbourhood grace owing to the recent demise of his trampoline. "God," says Glenda, coming in damp from the kitchen as usual, the kitchen always unaccountably damp, and Glenda always arriving 30 seconds after an accident. "Your mother will love this. She hates that cabinet." Glenda's bringing me a gin and tonic. Alcohol plays no part in this story. It's just that taking a glass from her requires me to lean forward in my chair, and this means I see James out on the street on his one true possession, a bicycle with the silver pedals, heading in the direction of the Wolfsons. This is the last moment I can account for him with any authority for some time, and what I want to do now is to recreate those hours before James left the house, a sea lily disguised as a small boy. I want to know what those hours were like for him. It's not easy. There's the police report, the security tapes, and Tony's brother's statement. These things help, but the difficulty lies in the task of remembering childhood, that busy time of waiting. Glenda's back is to the window. She doesn't see him. Glenda gave birth to Greg, and then James, with the flustered enthusiasm with which she approaches most activities. For some times afterward, it was very easy to keep track of their movements. My parents supplied us with state-of-the-art devices intended to attach children to other things, strapped across our chests, immobile in the back seat of the car, bouncing in small buggies that fastened to Glenda's bicycle. Initially, we functioned as tour guides to their lives, arranging for them to be moved from place to place. It didn't last. First Greg, then James, acquired additional life. Their tiny bodies seemed designed for the express purpose of running quickly and cannily through department stores. Linda showed the strain, so my mother took her to a day spa to be smothered in cool creams that smelled of supermarkets. "Philip," my mother said when they returned from the spa, "I'm worried about Glenda. I hope you're looking after her. She seems subdued." Glenda, uncharacteristically immobile with her aromatherapy, lay across the couch, waiting for my mother to leave as the boys stacked brightly coloured plastic blocks around her feet. It's not that Glenda doesn't get on with my parents. It would be difficult not to get on with them. They're tanned, wear crease-free clothing, and play sociable tennis. They love Glenda and the boys with the kind of generosity that means they'll come by for an impromptu visit and, if we're out, wait in their car until we get home. Glenda will sigh as we pull into the driveway, a small sigh that I can hear, but the boys can't. "We're just passing," my mother will call, extracting herself from the hot car with the plucky expression of a dehydrated dog. My father's arms will be full of bread rolls and newspaper cuttings, and a book Glenda mentioned she liked the sound of a week ago. Our house feels smaller when they're in it, more untidy. My mother has expressed her concern at our practice of allowing the boys out to play unsupervised in the neighbourhood. She once discussed it with me in the garden, where only the magpies and I could hear her. "It was fine when you were young," she said with a thin, tanned voice, "but things aren't the same these days." "They never go more than 3 blocks away," I told her, "and we have neighbourhood watch." "You know, I don't often comment on your parenting," she said, looking around the garden from fence to fence, window to window, as if scouting for disguised dangers about which I know nothing. The boys' social life may be confined to 2 or 3 streets, but it's still complex, fluid, and frequently involves Glenda and me in unexpected situations. James, then, on this hot afternoon, experiencing the injustice of being barred from home, the humid, repetitive, earthbound feeling of not occupying the ocean floor. James goes in search of his brother on his silver-pedalled bicycle. As soon as he received this bicycle from his grandparents, for no reason, I might add, it just arrived one day, James customised it with stickers of half-men, half-monsters. Glenda's reaction to the stickers was, "Your grandfather gave you that bike, and he isn't going to like these." I couldn't tell you the exact moment Glenda began living as if my parents were watching her every move through secret cameras embedded in unnecessary gifts. "This one is especially gruesome," I said, inspecting a particular sticker. It featured something green which appeared muscular despite its delicate tentacles. "I know," said James, conspiratorial. "He doesn't eat. He photosynthesizes." This is the bike that James rides away on, basically homeless. That's how his head seems, small and homeless. I look at the china cabinet, then at Glenda. "You can take the boys to the hardware store tomorrow," she says. "They love it there." That's true. Even Greg never fails to be impressed by the number of small, shiny things in the world. This is what I think happened. James found his brother 1 street away at the Wolfsons, and Greg was unhappy to see him. The accumulating sorrow, evicted from home, and now unwelcomed by a brother. I know the Wolfsons yard well, because I've negotiated it when tipsy. It's all paving, swimming pool, and plants in pots. Bev Wilson holds parties lit by candles and the moist glow of this obstacle course greenery. Glenda and I wonder if their plants are fake because they're jealous of their swimming pool, despite the temporary feel of its above-ground installation. "Imagine having a swimming pool like that," says Glenda. "I'd spend all day in it, naked." My answer to this is that I would reapply her sunscreen. This is the world of patio foliage and older boys that James has entered, the flimsy pool full of children, water coming over the side like surf. Greg, damp but dressed and ready to leave. The brief argument, James sullen and imploring, Bev Wilson shimmying around with towels and Diet Coke and painted toenails. Greg is unimpressed at James' arrival because he has plans to meet his friend Tony, whose older brother is a shopping centre security guard. When were these plans made? Some interior minute we couldn't monitor. Greg makes phone calls when we least expect it, curling his entire body around the phone, giving and taking quick instructions and behaving afterward as if nothing had happened. He sends emails from my computer. Every now and then I surprise him at my desk, looking like a small, efficient workday version of me. At any given moment, he could be making arrangements to meet up with a security guard one Friday when we are tired and lax and stunned by the end of the week. A street away, safely at the Woolsons, Greg is shrugging his shoulders and agreeing to let James come along to an empty shopping centre. There are times when he shrugs that way at me too, slouchy and resigned. It's like I'm literally on his back. Then he shrugs, and I'm off. The bicycle stays at the Wolfsons because Tony's security guard brother has a car. Bev Wolfson will find the bike later, after the rainstorm, stickers wet and peeling, collapsed among the pot plants in a blur of mosquitoes. The police report doesn't give the colour of Tony's brother's car. Let's say it's blue. My first car was blue, almost navy. It shook on the highways and leaked in every kind of weather. My parents wanted to buy me a new one, but I insisted on paying for my own. Glenda filled it with apple cores and covered the door of the glove compartment with the fruit stickers. Tony's brother's car is only minimally insured because the sound system is worth more than the car itself. This is the kind of information you can pick up about a person. Glenda's sister works in an insurance call centre, and we had her check him out. She typed his name into the system with those long, pearly artificial nails that make her do everything with the last-minute flicks of a flamenco dancer. Tony's brother drives his car to work. Although he could walk, the shopping centre is only 3 blocks from his house, through the roundabout at Hughes Road and across the car park. It's true, these places aren't designed for pedestrians. Who knows what might happen to security guards leaving shopping centres alone on foot at dawn? Tony sits up front, and our boys climb into the back. They fasten their seatbelts without being asked, just as they always do. Tony's brother looks over his shoulder from the driver's seat. He's good-looking, sports promising jowls, grooms a bit of stubble, and wears a zip-up jacket. He asks, "How old is this kid anyway?" 8, says Greg. At the same time as James says, "I'm 8. The boys have been to this shopping centre hundreds of times, but not when it's empty and not behind the scenes. They'll enjoy this. James because he likes knowing how things work, Greg because he likes knowing things other people don't. Tony's brother takes the boys into a room and says, "This is my office." James and Greg both know it isn't exactly an office. They've visited me at work, but there are more interesting things to touch here: switches, telephones, television screens. James finds a map of the shopping centre and walks his finger around it. He's particularly good with maps. He brings them home from school and sits at the kitchen table to colour them in. This, I think, is what our table was made for. James enjoys school in the same way that Greg enjoys ball sports. This week, he's learnt about unusual underwater animals. Dense, dark water fish with built-in light globes. Poisonous rock pool octopi. Sea lilies. What if we'd had 2 girls? Bev Wilson has 2 girls, twins just a little older than Craig. Last time I saw them, they were in the kitchen sharing headphones, each with a pod in one ear, jumping up and down in sync. Glenda would like a girl. It's something she'd like, but doesn't feel she needs. "Do you know what?" she'd said more than once. "One day your mother will walk in here and give me one, gift-wrapped." "All right, boys," says Tony's brother. "Let's take a walk." Now that they're in the shopping centre, it doesn't matter what time of day it is. The lights are dimmed, and for hours it will be evening. The place looks as if it's just been evacuated after a disaster warning. James is thinking about the time. I know he thinks about it because it's often a topic of conversation for him. In a minute, he'll say, while I'm combing my hair or brushing my teeth, Mum's going to come in here and tell you we're late. And she does. Greg is walking up front with Tony's brother. Tony's on the loose, stopping and starting, running ahead, falling behind. It's like he's playing tennis with himself. He's one of those kids. He gets nosebleeds, but on him they look macho, blood on his lips, making fists. He's chunky and quick, checking things out. He'll exchange a few words with James. Hey, he says, that huge Christmas tree is hollow. They're in the central court of the mall now, and it's set up for Christmas. There's a plush red and gold Santa throne looking vaguely degenerate on a stage. There's tinsel and holly, fake snow, and bright green three-story Christmas tree, 15 metres of plastic pine. I wonder how they assemble those enormous trees, how many pieces there are to them, and where they live for the months they aren't required. James is wondering this, too, as he inspects the tree, the globes of red and gold floating in it, the fact of its hidden cavity. His gaze follows it up and up among the shopping centre levels that are strung together with escalators and boughs of synthetic holly, and the cameras whose video screens Tony's brother is supposed to keep an eye on. And being James, he's struck by the tree's undersea immensity in half-light. The end of the sun comes through the skylight above them, and it's like looking up from the other side of water. Greg is on Santa's throne. Here comes his voice, girlish and convincing. He's saying something like, I am the lord of all I survey, of half-price CDs and ladies' underwear and small white fences designed for keeping kids in line while they wait to see Santa. Greg is a keen observer of concrete objects, and we have high hopes for his sense of irony. James, he says, get up here. Hey, says Tony, why are all the escalators blocked off? They're stopped anyway. This is when Glenda looks out the window and says, where are those boys? What's Tony's brother doing now? What do security guards do in empty shopping centres? Here are some possibilities. They stroll around with torches, wearing caps and pretending to be burglars. They window shop. They pluck tiny spiders out of fake foliage. I've heard that celebrities sometimes come to malls after hours and things are kept open for them. Princess Diana did, sometime in the 80s, on one of her visits. She strolled and chatted and did some shopping. I've also heard that in the 80s, shop mannequins were modelled on her features. It must have been quite a life, shopping amongst yourself in an empty store at night. Could be Tony's brother is noticing a lot of things at once. The rain that started to come up, brief, sweaty summer rain, with the sky yellow and no clouds that you'd noticed. Tony fooling with the escalator barriers, trying to swing them back or push them aside. James heading towards his brother on the throne. Something about James is that he's always neat. No laces undone, nothing creased, never sloppy. Like a miniature version of my father, Glenda always says. His hair falls in a natural part, with a kind of subdued wonder, because hers doesn't. Could be that Tony's brother is sitting on the raised red stage, smoking a cigarette, and knowing no one will stop him. He must bring girls here. So James, says Greg, kicking affectionately at his brother, what do you want for Christmas? A new china cabinet. Greg laughs. He has a spooky laugh, man-sized, although he's not a man. James' face gets the look it does when he's made Greg laugh, happy and speculative. There's always the risk that Greg will stop. Get up here, Greg says. I'm Santa. James sits on Greg's knee. Hey, calls Tony, halfway up the escalator. This tree's so big, you could sit in it. Glenda makes a call to Bev Wilson. The rain stops while she dials. Bev says, Glenda, come for a drink. The boys are probably in the yard. They'll be among the hordes. Why don't you come over? Springville. Bev's talking so loud I can hear her. I shake my head at Glenda, and Glenda shakes her head into the phone. Do you mind checking, just quickly? Glenda asks. Where's Tony's brother at this moment? Checking out a noise in a loading bay. He may have a walkie-talkie somewhere on his zip-up jacket. The smoke from the cigarette is going up, up, up. What about you? Says James. What do you want for Christmas? I've got a list, Greg answers. I've sent it already. This concerns James. He knows in a solemn and informed way that Santa Claus isn't real. He assumes Greg knows this too, but now he isn't sure. He looks up to the second floor mezzanine, where a diminished Tony is circling the tree like a compact angel, inspecting it from all directions. Who'd you send your list to? James asks. To Grandpa and Pop. Who else? They give the best stuff. James knows this. We all know this. Even Glenda has buckled under the pressure. Mum and Dad give good stuff, says James. Greg says, Then he says, it's all educational. Maybe Tony's brother is right there, thinking about Christmas, the nuts and candles and bad wine, the old people who knew you when you were young. He leans against the stage, removes his jacket, places his walkie-talkie beside him. Tony has finally found himself the perfect position, a branch, the balcony rail, a small step into the tree. He yells down to them, his voice echoing and enormous. I could get into it from here, he says. Think it's stable? Bev hurries in from the yard. Imagine her agile steps among the plants. The boys aren't here, she says, and she reports James' bike. There's a small moment when you begin to wonder, and in the middle of it, you remain calm. Glenda finds more phone numbers, the barters, the cars. I say, I'll take a drive. It's not all educational, says James, but he's scanning through a mental list of every gift we've ever given him, and it's true, there's always an agenda. Keep quiet, learn to read, hand-eye coordination, ancient cultures. By now, Tony is in the tree. Who but a kid like Tony would think to climb into that tree? He just stepped right into the middle of it. I've seen him on the CCTV tape, quiet and at a distance. Tony, slightly fuzzy in black and white, stepping into the tree like a chunky chaplain, slapstick and crazy. He's got 19 seconds, and he lets out what I'd call a whoop, some kind of sound that had to do with height and secrecy and finding things out and with disobedience, with being in space, the new view, the absurdity of it. He pockets a bauble, like a thief or a bird, and he's both making a place in the tree, rearranging it, shifting things round up there. Tony's got it. He's riding that tree. He's found his footing. What a feeling to be in the middle of all that, a kid like Tony looking around, looking down. The tree shakes a little, unhappy, like something in the fairy tale, waking up. I'm driving slowly with my window down, watching pedestrians and making people uncomfortable. Everyone's out after the rain, walking on the wet grass, following dogs, peering into flower beds. The birds are crazy with the late sun. The houses are transparent and available, curtains open for early Christmas trees, back doors visible through front doors, and pieces of smoke-filled garden. In each house, someone is on the phone. You can hear their phone voices in the street, and it's as if Glenda has called every one of them all at the same time. There are small boys kicking soccer balls across yellow front lawns. There are boys climbing trees to retrieve lost objects, and boys at windows pressing their open mouths against cool glass. I wonder when this place got to be so wholesomely full of childhood. None of the boys looks like James or Greg, not even for a hopeful moment. I go through the Hughes Road roundabout twice. The shopping centre rises out of exit ramps and bright banners, and the kind of low bushes that can withstand drought and exhaust fumes. There are barriers over all the entrances. In my head, I compose a list of things I need to buy there tomorrow. A new belt, bulk laundry liquid, stamps. I'll take the boys for a milkshake before we go to the hardware store. I keep floating the car through our avenues and drives and boulevards and crescents until the streetlights come on. They say, nothing to worry about, nothing to worry about. So does Tony, nothing to worry about. Then the tree comes down. It takes 40 seconds at least for the tree to fall, and for Tony to fall with it, and for the shaking of the knotted branches to subside. The tree settles against the stage, and the tiled floor and the columns wrap with holly leaves. Once this settling has taken place, the tree has fallen. It has fallen in two pieces. But the star that sat on top of it is hanging in midair, held by an invisible cord, three floors up and circling like a disco ball. There are gold-coloured globes rolling across the floor, speeding down the slope that accelerates shopping trolleys towards the car park. The tinsel and the fake pine needles rustle in a peculiar way, wind-blown and floor-stunned. The tree is so fake, it smells like Christmas, like plastic ribbon and shopping bags and wrapping foil. If you look closely at the branches, you can see the way the short brown fronds have been woven into long green ones to replicate the look of a real pine tree just past its perfectly green prime. You can see the way plastic pine cones grow out of the branches like natural accidents. The tree covers the children. Viewed from above, with the security camera's eyes, they're completely hidden. Here's Tony's brother. He's been hired for a reason. He's unafraid, highly trained, possibly armed. He knows first aid. And I mean, really knows it. He's assisted more than one old-age pensioner, overwhelmed by the size of the shopping centre. Apparently, this is how he spends his day shifts, crouching next to old men as they lie with their heads on his folded zip-up jacket, waiting for their children to arrive. This is the kind of information you can pick up about a person. Here's Tony's brother, finding Tony in the branches. Tony isn't moving. Where are Tony's parents at this moment? Their names are Aldo and Lara. We know them in the abbreviated way that comes of having children in the same year at school. Tony and Greg haven't been friends for long, so we haven't yet memorised the angle at which you must back out of their driveway or the smells that emanate from their house just before dinner. Maybe they're at the supermarket buying steak or oranges. Maybe they're taking advantage of Tony's absence and having sex. Maybe they're too tired for sex. Maybe Lara is showering while Aldo walks the dog. Whatever they're doing, they're intact. But Tony, at this moment, isn't moving. He's managed somehow to keep his grip on the tree's thick trunk, but his hands are held there by twisted wires and his back against another branch is bent too far. His brother knows not to move him. He's trained for this. A version of this, but Tony is his brother. Tony is not my son. Tony's brother calls out to the boys still sitting on Santa's throne. The tree has fallen just shy of them on their right side. Its wide branches form a glade over their heads, and in this forested darkness, the boys sit quietly, unsure of how to answer. Tony's brother has forgotten their names. He calls, "Kids, kids!" And eventually they call back, "Yes?" James, 8. Greg, 11. In a testament to his luck and ball skills, Greg has managed to catch a flying red bauble the size of his brother's head. James has a lapful of PVC pine needles, and these make scratch marks on his knees. The throne, bolted to the stage, has held back other branches. Thinking of this, the boys in their felled forest, I wonder, really? Can this be all? Our boys can see Tony through a tunnel of green, and they see Tony's brother climbing over to him in the tree. "Your boy's all right?" asks Tony's brother. "He's dialing emergency." Greg says, "Yeah." The boys are pushing now through the branches, which bend away with ease and then spring back. Greg jumps down from the stage and turns to help James do the same. It looks like they're emerging from the carcass of a monster. "You know the way back to my office?" asks Tony's brother. Greg doesn't. I know your office, says James. Then he runs. I can see him running, arms moving backward and forward, good at reading maps, knowing how to find an office. And Greg follows him, wondering how he knows. I know what happens next. There's no need to speculate. I'm down at the train station when Greg calls. I've parked the car and am standing on the bridge across the tracks, looking at the platform and checking the illuminated tops of heads. A train comes as we speak, and it doesn't stop or even slow, but races through. I'm coming, I say. And I go. I drive to the shopping centre, to the loading bay, and there, among the lights of the emergency vehicles, I see our boys. I haven't called Glenda yet. I will, when I've seen them. I don't want her to have to wait for bits of news, but to hear it all at once. And I don't want to go home to her without them. This is how I explain it, later. But the truth is, I don't think of her, not really, until I see them sitting there on a pile of flattened cardboard. Their poses are identical, hands in fists and placed on knees, and they look up and out beyond themselves, as if waiting for a photo to be taken. They're fine, they're whole, and I wonder for the first time, really? Can this be all? It's dark when we turn into our street. My parents' car is in the drive, and my father helps my mother out of it. I see the way he holds her elbow as she bends and straightens. Glenda must have called and asked them to come. I know this because they have no gifts and because she's waiting there on the lit front steps. They go to her, and my mother holds her. My father puts one hand up on her head. There is a day in the future when one of them will fall and find it difficult to recover, when one of them will receive a diagnosis or become forgetful or weak. I wonder which of them will be the first. Unnecessary Gifts by Fiona McFarlane from her collection The High Places, published by Hamish Hamilton.
And that's all in this 500th edition of Cover to Cover. My thanks to Barry Liveney and to all the readers over the years, far too many to mention individually. I'm Tim McQueen. Until next time, goodbye.
Thanks for listening to this Vision Australia Radio podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on your preferred podcast platform. Visit varadio.org for more.
Vision Australia Radio.
Blindness. Low vision.
Opportunity.